Good morning. If people want to take their seats, we're going to start. My name is Beth Cole, and I'm with the U.S. Institute of Peace with our Center for Post-Conflict Peace and Stability Operations. I've had the pleasure over the last couple of years of running a program here called Filling the Gaps, where we've attempted to look at areas in reconstruction and stabilization where we have consistently gotten failing grades. One of those areas is the role of women. And so I'm really pleased today to be able to not only release our report that resulted from a series of meetings of a working group, many of you are in the room that participated, of practitioners, of people with serious experience on the ground dealing with these issues. We are going to release that report today. The second one is a report that was sponsored by the Stanley Foundation in cooperation with Women in International Security, United Nations Reform, Improving Peace Operations by Advancing the Role of Women. That's outside. And finally, a report that was by the Joan B. Kroc Institute for Peace and Justice and UNIFEM. Oh, I have a nice copy. That resulted from a series of meetings, Who's Making Policy, What Difference Does It Make, an International Conference on Gender-Inclusive Decision-Making for Peace with Justice. Before I begin, I just want to say that we're doing what women do, which is we're stepping in for other women. Our main speaker, in fact, someone who participated in all three of these reports, was unable to join us today. She unfortunately had a family emergency and called us from the airport in Baton Rouge last night. So we're going to step up and we're going to fill in, and that's not unusual for women. We do that. In fact, what we're going to talk about today is women bearing the brunt of these operations and stepping in and how we're trying to help them fulfill that role. I'm not going to introduce our very distinguished panel. I've given you bios, and I encourage you to read those bios. Suffice it to say that we have first Harriet Henschus, who's kind of old home week here today. Harriet was the executive vice president here at the Institute, and during her time here was co-chair of the Role of Women Working Group for us. And it's wonderful to have Harriet here. She's going to kick off. We then have Ambassador Hattie Babbitt, who's also no stranger to many of you. She headed the Hunt Alternatives Fund, Women for Inclusive Security, or Women Waging Peace. I don't know what we're supposed to call it now. but one of the preeminent women's organizations dealing with these issues. We're then going to go to Chantal. Chantal, can you tell me the correct pronunciation of your name, please? I don't want to get it wrong. Chantal,
the young
Atrat. Chantal is vice president of Women for in International Security, also an organization well known to us, a membership organization that really helps women here in Washington learn about jobs and opportunities in this field. And finally, then we'll have Joyce New, who's a senior fellow here at USIP. We're very fortunate. She's come from San Diego, and she will talk about her report. And then I will try my best to fill in for Camille. So let me turn this over to Harriet. Thank you, Harriet.
Well, I'm pleased to be back home and pleased to reengage with this subject matter. Hattie and I had a chance to talk on Friday, and having been away from the material big time, I was comforted by the fact that Camille was going to be here, who knew so much and was going to take up most of the time. And so when I opened up my email this morning, I said, oh, no. But it all comes back, and it comes back because I think that the issues that we grappled with during this working group were so real and brought together so many issues. At the same time, I was chairing a working group on the role of entrepreneurs in post-conflict, entrepreneurs and economic development in post-conflict stabilization. And the issues overlap and are interrelated, as are so many of the other pieces in the series that the Institute is doing on post-conflict stabilization. And maybe after we've had a chance, we can talk more, or Beth can talk more about that. It was a natural to talk about women in post-conflict stabilization. It wasn't exactly a neglected topic. It was neglected in policy and practice, but it wasn't neglected in thinking about it. One of the amazing things was, to me, was how much work had been done on the role of women. We even paused at one point and said, should we do this? Now, we didn't do it just within the Institute. We reached out to a number of organizations that you've already had reference to, but also within the State Department, within the Defense Department, work that had been going on. So we felt that recognition of the problem and of the issue had been there, and that there had been many efforts to try to understand all the different components of that issue. And there had been research by scholars, there had been working groups and task force and commissions. There was really no lack of it. I think what we felt we could do is step back and pull from the best of these and see what we could add to the discussion. And the discussions, I think, were very rich because of the diversity of the participants in those sessions. There were also some general conclusions, and one that there, despite all of this, there were no overarching strategies and no mandated programs to come out of all this research. Part of the issue was that they were directed to different audiences and different players. So the UN was looking at the UN system, and research scholars might have been looking at a particular piece of it. So we felt that there was an opportunity to pull together in a more comprehensive way and in a consolidated way some of the recommendations and highlights of best practices. I think the lessons learned were not vigorous. The research, for those who would read it, was very compelling, but somehow the connections weren't being made across policy lines, and I think that's one of the efforts that we made, and I think with some success in that. Because of all this, there's not a lot of new in this report. What is new, I think, is an effort to zero in on specific recommendations. We decided to direct our recommendations to the U.S. government. That's another issue that so many of the studies did go across all the players. And we paused at that. We said, well, there's the EU, there's the UN, how should we? But we said the U.S. government is close enough to home. There's a pretty good prediction it will be involved in future post-conflict stabilization operations. We also knew that there was the possibility of leadership in what it would do. So we kept coming back to what should the U.S. government do at this point. There were some things we heard over and over again. Women are not part of the power structure. This was an observation and work that had been done on how to make foreign assistance more effective. But it's the very reason why you needed to focus on women, and I think it's the reason why they have unique value added in the post-conflict stabilization. They don't have positions to protect. And the less they have to protect, the less you have some of the root causes of the conflict in the first place. I think we also felt that we needed to highlight the window of opportunity that post-conflict period provided for changing roles, to advance the rights of women so that they could play different roles, and even to the extent that we looked at recommendations that we knew wouldn't be very popular, but that we were willing to put ourselves in favor of. I'm only going to talk about two of the recommendations. Call them my personal favorites. One is the recommendation of quotas in the political system. This is one where it didn't seem quite kosher. People were very hesitant about them. There were pros and cons, and clearly there are pros and cons. But we said, no, we think that this is important for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is it forces relinquishment of control by the power structures. So if they can't have 100% of the seats and they have to give up 20-25%, that means 20 or 25% perhaps of the old guard who aren't going to be in those legislative positions. It was an opportunity to build critical mass among a new set of players. What you have is women who might not have put themselves forward who now feel that the competition is perhaps not so daunting, and it builds experience. And to me, this was the most important thing. If women ran for election and lost, that's all right. They were going to learn a lot. They were going to be visible. They were going to articulate the issues in a way that men might not. And personally, I would say I think that we ought to err on the side of using quotas in any way that we can shape constitutions or regulations in this area. The question of how long, I don't think we had to deal with. I think you let a democracy mature, and then it will decide whether it's appropriate to continue those. But I think the arguments for it far outweigh whatever the deficiencies might be. And certainly a lack of experience is one of them. Sometimes judgment trumps experience. The second area, which I think, and it's less than a page in this report, but which is one that I feel very strongly about, and it is jam-packed. I'd say if you don't read any other section, I think this has really got a lot of meat in it, and it's the promoting of social economic development and the roles of women. The research that was brought together there was that income in the hands of women significantly has greater impact on community than in the hands of men. It's not research we did. I take the scholars, and there is, I think, a fairly strong array of research in this regard. Borrowing by women has a tremendous impact on other social aspects, child nutrition, school enrollment, demand for health care. Borrowing by men is going into some of the same traditional areas that didn't yield benefits to society. It also has the impact of uplifting the social status of women. The tool that we particularly highlighted, and I think is probably fairly new in this report, maybe not so much now because it's been a while since we did it, is the use of contracting legislation language in contracts. The Department of Defense used it. It caused some of the contractors to scramble to figure out, well, you know, what does it mean? And they themselves had to then fill in the blanks. I don't know that the initial language was particularly helpful. Again, this forces inclusion. It forces a different perspective. And I think that subsequently, and maybe there's somebody in the room who knows what happens, it has happened, is that there was a list being put together of experiences of using women and also of lists of organizations, say, in Iraq. And so that's very helpful. And I don't know, she's a student at Harvard, Gail Samek, has done a series of studies on the role of women in Bosnia, Rwanda, and Afghanistan in a post-conflict setting, and some of the case studies of it. They're very interesting. She's written for the Financial Times. She did some things. The pieces I saw were from the Chamber of Commerce site, Center for International Private Enterprise. And very, very good. Just remarkable stories about women not using microcredit and moving more into the space of small and medium-sized enterprises. And what was a big motivating factor for them was the number of jobs it would create. And I think this is a little off the topic, but I think that an overemphasis on microcredit relegates women to a marginal part of the economy and does not create jobs. So I think that this is perhaps an area that if research has not begun, and there's some interesting programs being done, post-conflict and not post-conflict, but I think that really needs to be paid attention. I think the conclusion is there was so much potential and so much experience being missed by not including women and doing even some not quite conventional pieces. I have only one caution, and that is when I read in the literature about women's skills, I think it misses the point. I don't think it's that we have unique skills, and to conclude that we do lessens the impact. I think it's our experience and our perspective that the roles that we've played give us some insights, in this case, in the post-conflict situation. These women were bystanders in some regards, but they were absolutely critical to both the playing out of the conflict, and they had the biggest impact. So I think that this was a very interesting working group, and it was I was delighted to dip back into the material.
Thank you. Ambassador?
Thank you very much. Thank you to Harriet for being such a good co-chair, and thank you for USIP for putting this together. And in absentia, thank you to Camille, who really did the hard work of putting together our report, and I'm learning all the rest of them. This is a task made especially hard, putting together one of these reports with so many elements, by having so many masters, or in this case, so many mostly mistresses, but Camille's work, I think, has produced a set of products that will be quite useful to you. Harriet and Camille and I have all moved on from our original positions since the time of the writing of the report, but all of us are very, very proud of the work that we were involved in, and very grateful to our institutions for continuing with it. This is really key stuff. I mean, this is a big gap. I've been on all sides of this front as a policymaker, a policy shaper, a head of an NGO, of everything, and I can tell you that the switch with respect to the inclusion of women isn't going to happen unless everybody at every level is involved. It just is too neuralgic on too many fronts and too difficult to process. So I'm very grateful for the Mickeys and Vicks and everybody who are still at it, and certainly to Camille, who, although no longer at the Initiative for Inclusive Security, is clearly still at it. Harriet mentioned that we decided to target our recommendations to the United States government. And that was, if you're giving a speech or you're writing an article or whatever you're doing, you need to understand who your audience is. So we really had to decide, and decided as a Washington-based effort, and because the U.S. government is a significant donor in many post-conflict situations, that we would tailor our recommendations to the United States government. Now, I looked at the report to refresh my memory about our work and realized that the Office of Stabilization and Reconstruction has now been merged into the Office of F, an office at the State Department which didn't exist when we wrote the report. And many of you were probably more enmeshed in the internal stuff involved with that merger. But whatever is happening in the internal structures in the United States government, and whoever is in power, whoever is running the government, these rooms are not full of people who are saying, how can I fail? How can we do this wrong? They may fail, or they may do it wrong, but they're not full of people who want to fail. And one of the great things about being involved with the Initiative for Inclusive Security and with this effort on behalf of USIP, in the filling the gaps, is that we on the outside can do our job in helping these people be successful. What the Initiative for Inclusive Security does is has done over the years is identify the women in the field so that when the people in the who are in the policy makers making the decisions say, oh God, we'd love to do that, we don't know who would we call in Sudan? I mean, how would we find a woman in Bosnia? You mean they're women in Cambodia? Whatever. We can say, yes, here's the list. Some of them are parliamentarians. Some of them run NGOs. Some of them are in the government. Here's our set. And we have and I'm offering these up to those of you in the audience. We have identified, I'm going to continue to use the WE for Initiative to Inclusive Security because it's still part of what of the things that I care about. We have identified 400 women peacemakers around the world, and from Sudan to Sri Lanka to Colombia to Bosnia to the Middle East to Sierra Leone. These are not ours. These are resources for everybody in this room and beyond, so that if you are looking for some expertise in one of these post-conflict areas around the world, you can go to our searchable database. You don't have to call Mickey. You don't have to call Vic. Please don't call me. You can go to our searchable database and find them. And if you need to call somebody at the Initiative Inclusive Security, terrific. But we hope that there are people in the United States government who have heard this message, and some of you who are from the United States government, but we also hope that other NGOs, I mean, we're here to spread the expertise and the talent, and these women can use their first-hand experience. What we in Washington have is lots of ideas and sometimes some diplomatic skills and sometimes some money, but we don't have as much on-the-ground experience. And the first-hand experience of these women is hugely important. Now, the other thing that the Initiative for Inclusive Security does is do advocacy work, you know, back in Washington here, and reach out to policymakers. Sometimes it's people on the Hill. I understand that folks are now working with Eddie Bernice Johnson on a resolution to urge the United States to comply with its commitments under UN Security Council Resolution 1325. They're working to get a hearing on all the issues surrounding women, peace, and security. And in a country-specific way, Mickey was just in November in Colombia, training on gender and transitional justice with the Colombia's National Commission for Reparation and Reconciliation, a key element in that country's set of structures to move forward. In Sudan, there was a November consultation again with 40 women leaders, both from the unity government and from civil society, who developed recommendations around Sudan's comprehensive peace agreement to make sure that it was, that people saw the windows for making sure that it was implemented in a gender-sensitive way. And after the consultation, the women parliamentarians created a women's cross-party caucus. That's a hugely important thing that can come out of this work that the United States, the donors do, and that we in this room do. And that is to say to women who've, you know, found themselves through the quota system or otherwise in these positions of authority, often with very little preparation to be in those positions of authority. It's not been the custom where they are. Nobody's had these kinds of positions because of the conflict. And now what do I do? Mm-hmm. Well, when they understand the power of working across conflict lines, across party lines, women working on behalf of health issues or common issues, and the power that that can give them in the community, it's extraordinary. Mm-hmm. In Liberia, the Initiative for Inclusive Security partnered with UNIFEM to host 18 women in Washington to work on the PSRP, the Poverty Reduction Strategy papers that the World Bank has countries put together to make sure that they're gender sensitive. Again, that's the kind of specific window into which we hope these kinds of recommendations from the USIP effort can work. On the research side, what the Initiative for Inclusive Security has done, and I'm going through what the Initiative for Inclusive Security has done because throwing a USIP, USIP is wonderful, but throwing a USIP joint report, Harriet and I are wonderful, throwing a USIP report over the transom isn't going to get into the U.S. government processes, even if Camille's drafted, we've worked on the perfect report with the finest tuned recommendations ever. So we had in the past done 11 case studies to show how women had contributed to transitional justice processes in Bosnia, to security sector reform in South Africa, to post-conflict governments in Rwanda, and 11 different ones. We then went on to work on a toolkit with International Alert, which was designed, we thought at the time, to translate the policy speak into language and a format that would be useful to women in the field, and that would sort of be that bridge between policymakers and policy shapers and practitioners and women in the field. It turned out to be so useful to practitioners and to policymakers in Washington that we've used it much more broadly. I don't have one for each of you, but I do have one to show what it looks like. Some of you, I hope many of you already have it. And it's on, Mick says, reminds me, it's on their DVD? Yes. CD.
CD-ROM.
The next step in all that, and this is where I have 3 stars by my presentation notes, is to go to the next step, and that is when you have a room full of policymakers. Again, these are not people who are trying to fail. These are people who are trying to succeed, and so you want to help them succeed. Inclusive Security and all these organizations and others have come up with this good work on recommendations. We're miles ahead of where we were when I was introduced to these subjects four or five years ago. Miles ahead. But you really need a how-to guide. The guys and these people are in a room. There's a moment, a window into which to have an impact, and they really need a how-to. So we're trying to, the Initiative for Inclusive Security is doing how-to guides, which will be this drill down even deeper into the recommendations that this report contains and how to. So if you all will fill out your forms, mm-hmm. you will be the lucky recipients of the how-to guides as they are published. And we welcome you all to plagiarize and use our women, use our research, use our advocacy tools, use our how-to guides. We have no proprietary interest in keeping this to ourselves. We only have a proprietary interest in having it be useful. So I hope you will all fill out these and use the reports.
Thank you. Chantal?
Thank you. First of all, thanks to you, Beth, and to USIP for organizing this panel and for inviting WISE to be here. Second, I have to tell you that I'm stepping in for somebody else as well, and that's actually for our executive director, Jolynn Schumacher, who is way more competent on this issue than I am. But she is in Boston today to open up a new WISE chapter. Increasingly, WISE is reaching out nationally and internationally, and we have to thank Jolynn for that, as well as our very energetic president, Pamela Al. I would like to make 3 sets of remarks. First, on the importance of the issue. Second, on WISE involvement in this issue. And third, then reflect maybe on some of the lessons that WISE has taken away from its recent initiative on how to help increase the number of women in leadership positions in UN peace operations. The importance of the issue. Now, this audience doesn't need to be reminded that it's important that women are fully engaged and integrated, included in peace processes, not just locally, but also internationally. That this is for reasons of equity as well as operational effectiveness. That said, for many people, including many UN member states, this is an issue that one pays lip service to, but for many, this is not really a priority. I think the declaratory policies of states and international organizations have changed enormously over the past 10 years, but at present, it remains in the realm of declaratory policy and not of actual policy. Yet, ignoring the role of women goes at our own peril. We have seen in recent experiences in East Timor, in Liberia, that the increase of women in leadership positions in peace operations can lead to very positive results. They're able to reach out to populations previously not reached. They can also give local women a boost to step up to the plate and fill in leadership positions. And I would agree with Harriet that, you know, it's not about skills, it is really about the experience and perspectives that these women bring. Nancy Soderberg, in a recent op-ed, said, you know, by failing to make maximum use of women to promote peace and security throughout the world, we are by definition only making a 50% effort. So I would say, you know, we need to continue to convince governments in particular that this is an important issue, and I think we need to work on the narrative for these governments. Second, WISE involvement in this issue. WISE has been involved in this issue since 1995, the Beijing conference, the UN conference on the advancement of women. In the late 1990s, early 2000, we also organized a conference on the role of women in conflict and post-conflict situations. But last fall, we launched a major new initiative to help increase the role of women in UN peace operations and increase the number of women, particularly in leadership positions. Now, we had four main reasons to want to undertake this project. First of all, frustration that, you know, the issue is not moving forward. Second, supporting the advancement of women in international peace and security is not just a core component of our mission, but I would say the core component of our mission. Third, WISE is a membership organization, and WISE is becoming increasingly international, both in terms of the issue it addresses as well as in terms of membership. And so this is a natural issue for us, because actually in our membership we might have potential leaders who could fill up these positions. And then lastly, the timing was right. The UN was getting a new Secretary General. The UN was looking for new ways to address this issue. The establishment of the Peacebuilding Commission was a positive development. And also we got very strong encouragement from UNDPKO, the Peacekeeping Department, to push for this issue. Within the UN, they really feel they need some help, some outside help to push this issue forward. And I think there, again, praise has to go to Jane Hall-Lute, the Assistant Secretary General for Peacekeeping Operations, former WISE board member, who is trying to push this issue very hard. Now, the WISE project on how to increase the number of women in leadership position in UN peace operations is a multi-phase project, and it has two main aims. One is to examine the obstacles to progress, and second, to try to come with policy recommendations and mechanisms that can increase the number of women. It is a collaborative project that tries to include and consult with as many people as possible, not just with organizations who have a solid and stellar track record on this issue, like the Initiative for Inclusive Security, but also organizations who are not traditionally involved in these type of issues, and to engage UN member states, UN missions to the UN. So the first phase of this project started early this year and consisted of a series of consultations both in New York and in Washington, D.C., and we're aimed at trying to sort of define the problem and identify areas for further research. These consultations were organized with the Stanley Foundation, which again was for us a great and natural partner. The Stanley Foundation is not known for its work on gender issues, but it is very well known for its work on the UN. And so this was a very nice cooperative project. Camille Conaway was our rapporteur for these two consultations, and the report is outside. And like the two Harriets, I want to sing the praise of Camille and have to tell you that we are very happy that she is now actively involved and engaged with this project of ours and will also be engaged in ulterior stages and phases of our project. To conclude, let me highlight sort of two of the lessons from these consultations. And there's both good news and bad news. The good news is that there is increasing awareness of gender goals and needs. There's increasing awareness that more women in leadership positions would lead to greater operational effectiveness. The bad news is that afterwards we really hit a stone wall. Moving from theory to practice is very difficult. And all the organizations, even those who are willing, are having great difficulty in practicing the theory of greater gender balance. So I think we need more research and creative thinking about the obstacles and impediments of having more women in leadership positions. We need to have an inventory of best practices, set up mechanisms to exchange information on these issues. And I would say we need to do this both at a national and international level. And the second phase of the WISE project will try to provide some data on these issues, and we'll also do a comparative examination of practices from different countries around the world and try to see if we cannot learn from each other. And ultimately, we hope that this more analytical, in-depth study will provide lessons not just for the UN, but also for NATO, the European Union, and other international organizations in this field. So maybe with that, I would like to leave it at this. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Chantal. Joyce.
Okay. Thank you, and I want to add my thanks to USIP and to Beth for organizing this panel. It's interesting to hear what we've all been doing in this area, and I do want to echo other comments, which is that a lot has been done on the issue of women and gender for many, many years. And for those of us who do work internationally, which I'm assuming is most of us in this room, I think we have a lot to learn from our colleagues overseas, who are often far more advanced in this than American men and women are. And so the focus that the Joan Kroc Institute for Peace and Justice has had is really on trying to document some of these stories. I think, as Ambassador Babbitt mentioned just in passing, women in war zones often have opportunities that they would never have had those countries stayed at peace. And they are then able to take unconventional positions, untraditional jobs that are culturally perhaps inappropriate, but in the case of a major conflict, someone has to do them. And so women step in, as Beth started our session with. Women often step up to the plate, as do good-willing citizens of any gender, I think. So our focus at the Institute for Peace and Justice in San Diego has really been to try to document some of the stories of some of these women, admittedly a few. Every year we bring in four outstanding women peacemakers, generally not household names. We're not looking for the famous names. We're looking for women who've been on the ground, really doing the work. Generally, one of the criteria we look at is whether, in fact, their lives are in jeopardy because of the work they're doing, and do they need a break to recharge their batteries. We bring them into the Institute. They're in residence with us for 2 months, during which time they go through a very intensive process of recapturing their stories. How did they do what they've done? A lot of these stories are now online for anyone interested, and I can give you the website. But part of this Women Peacemakers program that we've had going now, this will be our fifth year, is an annual conference that we hold, really focused around the implementation of UN Security Council Resolution 1325. And again, if you are not familiar with the UN Security Council Resolution 1325, I would encourage you to go to the UN website and look at Security Council. They have the resolutions there, and you can just pull it up. But it's on the inclusion of women in all phases of peace processes. And again, I'm assuming most of you in the audience know this, but for those of you who don't, I don't want you to feel left out by not knowing what this is. The Institute has been an affiliate, has had affiliate status at the UN for the last 4 years, ever since we could qualify, and we attend the Commission on the Status of Women meeting every spring. Again, for those of you interested in international, what women are doing around the world, I would really encourage you to attend. So this conference that I'm going to be reporting on was our third annual conference on who's making policy, what difference does it make, if women are included or not. We had 120 participants from over 20 countries, and we had men and women. One of the things that we are really trying to do is to encourage the participation of men in our conferences. Gender does not belong to women. And if the only advocates for gender equality are women, then again, I think we lose part of the battle. We need to have the Mickeys and the Donald Steinbergs and the people out there who are really also focused on getting women to the table.
Steve Steiner.
All right. There we go. Thank you. So I'm going to just give you some of the findings of our conference, of this most recent conference, looking at both kind of the negative findings and the positive findings, and just to run through them. One of the findings is that women, of course, continue to be excluded from peace processes, from peacekeeping and security operations. And some of the reasons for this that were discussed at the conference include the cultural norms of men's right to participate at local, national, international levels excludes women. That there is somehow an inherent right for men to participate, whereas women may be okay at the local level, but at national and international levels may not be. Another issue is that international organizations, both NGOs and intergovernmental organizations, have a culture of how they do things when they go into a country. Anything that hinders that process is not seen as favorable, which is one of the reasons that many of us, when we go into other countries, we either have our own local partner who somehow we've trained to meet our standards and to do it our way, or we don't include locals. And for many people dealing with crisis areas, it's very hard to, you know, try to incorporate them. But that also excludes women from these. It excludes men as well, but it bypasses any potential contribution of local actors. Because they don't do it kind of the cultural way of those institutions. There is also the notion that inclusion of one woman is inclusion of all, and this is the notion of tokenism. So if you've got one woman at the table, then that means that, okay, she's going to represent women. Well, you know. There are also assumptions out there about women's roles in war and peace that are no longer accurate. There are assumptions that women are victims as opposed to women are combatants. Therefore, when you have DDR programs, demobilization, disarmament, reintegration programs, they deal with male combatants, but they very rarely deal with the needs of female combatants, and they're not structured to deal with the needs of female combatants. So in peacekeeping operations, what you have right now is that women make up 30% of the civilian staff of peacekeeping operations, 5% of police forces, and 1% of the military. Now, as some of you may know, there was just an all-women peacekeeping mission deployed to Liberia from India. And that's a start. They don't need to be all female, but it's a start of getting more women included in peacekeeping operations. Another issue touched on here is that no matter how many resolutions, treaties, and conventions and laws that we have on the inclusion of women and the necessity of including women and documenting the positive effects of the inclusion of women for all people in society, men, women, and children, in fact, strategies and implementation for their inclusion are lacking, as is accountability. So we have 1325 on the books as a UN Security Council resolution, and one of the organizations most in violation of 1325 is the UN, which at the moment, in terms of all of their crisis actors, the UN special representatives of the Secretary General who go out to intervene in crises, I think at the moment there may be one woman in a deputy position out of more than 30, 40, 50 total. So we need to work on accountability. Distrust and fear of what gender inclusion means, so it's better to leave them out because we don't know how that will threaten us. How does it fit in an agenda for security sector reform, for example? And finally, exclusion because of the hyper-masculine culture that you often find in peace operations, in military operations, with the fear of women not fitting in. Even in the U.S. military, you will find that women report very high levels. Women military report high levels of abuse, and this is not exclusive to the U.S. The positive gains that we found have been made include that more peace agreements are recognizing and including women's rights and gender equality, that gender inclusion is now often part of post-conflict planning and resource distribution. Even if people don't necessarily know what it means or how to do it, it's on the table as part of a discussion. So it's starting. Women are taking part in micro-disarmament programs unofficially, as we find with many of the women peacemakers that we have, one of whom is a very tiny woman who's worked with the USIP program in Mindanao. She just goes out and talks to the police on her own and tries to negotiate safe corridors and tries to get them to disarm, and has been incredibly successful in doing so. There is another gain which results, I think, from former Foreign Minister Lloyd Axworthy's emphasis on human security in foreign policy, and that is, and that I believe has spread into the larger international arena, which benefits women's inclusion by kind of expanding the notion of security to include the whole notion of human security, basic needs, etc. Another thing I think we need to be very careful about is that increasing the numbers of women in peacekeeping operations and in peace processes does not guarantee gender sensitivity. In fact, as Jane Hall Lute herself would admit, she is the Assistant Secretary General in charge of peacekeeping, used to be the head of the Carnegie Commission for Preventing Deadly Conflict, used to be an Army captain, used to be NSC advisor. I mean, she's got quite a resume. I think Jane was probably one of the last people who would have been gender sensitive. And I think she would agree to that. She has only recently really become aware of this. So simply having women is not necessarily better than having men if you have people who are very committed to gender inclusion. And so just the fact that you have females, you need to be careful about. There is, however, something called the critical mass mm-hmm. phenomenon, which is once you have a certain number of women present, and it's usually, I think, deemed to be about one-third, if you have one-third participants women, then there does tend to be a significant outflow of that positive effect. So finally, if you are interested, I don't have enough copies of this report here. It is downloadable on a PDF form from the Joan Kroc Institute for Peace and Justice website. In October this year, there will be the fourth or fifth annual conference that we're holding on Is Peace Possible? And so for any of you interested in coming to San Diego in the fall, I'll look forward to seeing you there. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Joyce. Well, Harriet was pointing out that this is maybe one of the first times that I can remember in at least the last year that we've had an all-women panel up here. So at least it's showing some progress.
Wow. On the subject of women.
On the subject of women. It's all right. We're getting there. One of the roles of the Institute is to convene organizations and to solicit from everyone that's doing such good work around the world and in Washington, you know, what are the best practices? And that was really the heart of our effort. But there was another overlay to our working group, and that was to take those best practices and to try to hone them into a very fine and concise set of recommendations. That is why our report, as you can see, is pretty thin. It's not one of these hefty reports. And there's a really important reason for that. We know that policymakers, that the Secretary of State, that Assistant Secretaries, that those who lead missions, that those who plan missions are very time-crunched, they're very time-pressed. And we wanted to get to them a set of actionable recommendations, maybe on one or two pages, that they could take with them on a plane, in a car, in their briefcase, as a set of core material that they could refer to when they were planning their mission or running their mission. And so I encourage you to look at our recommendations. It was extremely difficult to take a group of, we had hundreds of women over a course of 6-month period, and to produce this
this kind of small set of recommendations. And as Harriet said, we talked about quotas often, frequently. We went off into tangents and we tried to get ourselves back again to what is it that we want to tell the guy that's running the mission and or the person that's planning the mission. And so we kept trying to refocus ourselves. So I hope this does make a contribution. I just want to just highlight a couple of things that Camille was going to say. I'm a poor substitute, but we should take away from this some optimism. The result of all these reports and all these working groups and all this work has been we have some positive indicators. Women are participating in ever increasing numbers in these operations and in the planning and execution of these operations. Joyce just talked about some of the figures. We're 25% or 30% now of civilian staff. That's not great, but it's pretty good. We're still low in participation on civilian police and, again, with military forces, but those numbers are also increasing. At the peace table, we have some very encouraging signs, and I'm just going to look at Afghanistan for a minute. As a result, the international community, including women here, pressed when the Bonn conference was occurring for women to participate in that conference. There were 6 out of 60 Afghan women. And those 6 out of 60, and the men had some role in this too, led to some very, very positive outcomes. A constitution with rights for women, women ministry, women ministers, and parliamentary quotas that we just talked about. That is not insignificant. Afghan women today are clearly better off and are clearly more a part of the process had this not occurred. The quota issue has been replicated across missions. And in Iraq, there's 31% of women now in the National Assembly. In Rwanda, it's 49%. In fact, the Interparliamentary Union said that the last 5 years have seen post-conflict countries feature prominently in the top 30 of the IPU's world ranking of women in national parliaments. In 2004, 7 developing countries, including Argentina, Mozambique, Rwanda, and South Africa, were among 17 countries with more than 30% women parliamentarians. But the countries that we have mounted operations in, Afghanistan, Eritrea, Iraq, Rwanda, and Uganda, all have 20 or up to 49% of women participating in parliaments. That's very significant. It goes back to what Joyce said, that there is this opportunity in a post-conflict environment, and we have chances to actually increase the participation and impact of women where we might not have it in a country that's at peace. In other examples, and we have a companion report on our website. Camille not only wrote the results of our deliberations in this glossy report, but she also has wrote a companion report of best practices that we solicited from people around the table over this 6-month period. Those are best practices. We couldn't include them in the big report, but it's really a beginning attempt to take a lot of the knowledge that we have and give policymakers best practices to buttress those recommendations. She has examples on DDR that are very positive. She has examples on the international tribunals, women's agitating for these international tribunals that resulted in Yugoslavia having one, in Rwanda and Sierra Leone, women participation as lawyers, judges, and prosecutors on those tribunals. She has detailed information about women's participation in economic opportunities and infrastructure. Joyce pointed out, or Harriet pointed out, the contracting provision. It is the contracting provision that the Department of Defense put into play in Iraq for women has had a tremendous effect. And we have some of that information that's detailed in a report that's just come out today on economic stabilization that we hope you'll be able to take with you. I hope we're going to put it out there. And so there's a lot that we should take heart from. Joyce did say that there are also some things that are not so positive. Out of all of the women that are leading missions today, the 18 UN missions, there's only one deputy SRSG that is a woman that I could find. And that's a serious problem. Women don't necessarily, as you pointed out, just having women doesn't necessarily lead to everything that you want. But if we see that women have an impact in parliaments, then we know that women can have an impact in missions from a leadership level as well. Condition of women in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Darfur, all these places is deteriorating. And so despite all the progress we've made, women are still continuing to suffer and bear the brunt of a lot of this, these problems. The UN Peacebuilding Commission is headed by a woman. There are now gender advisors in 18 UN, in 10 out of 18 UN missions, and gender focal points in 6. There is the State Department Office for Reconstruction and Stabilization. They are very, very open to our input. In fact, they were one of the chief, if you will, recipients of the work that we did here. They are going to hopefully get quite a large chunk of money from the Congress in the next year. They will be assembling U.S. personnel to go out to missions. It is a credible opportunity for us. I think we've turned the corner. I think they're going to succeed. They haven't quite been merged into F. They're still going to retain their separate identity. But I think that the collective work of a lot of us will finally come to fruition, and that they will not only just be a place where we can give recommendations, but they'll be actually able to put those into some operational context as they get money to deploy people to operations. So there's a lot that we should take from here and be optimistic about, despite all the challenges. I want to just recognize, before I turn it all over to you, to participate in discussion, because there's a wealth of people here that have probably a lot more knowledge than even collectively we do up here. But I want to acknowledge the special role of Steve Siner in our working group. Steve is at the State Department. He has been a relentless advocate for women. He was just in our office last week saying, "Got to help the Iraqi women. How are we going to do this? We got to," and he just never stops. And he was, along with Mickey, one of the several honorary male members of our working group, and it was just really, it's really wonderful to have you guys in the room. So I'm going to stop with that. I can't do justice to the work that Camille has done, I've tried my best to pinch hit, but I want to turn it all over to you and give us your comments, feedback, questions, and if you could come up to the microphones and introduce yourself.
I have a first question while somebody's coming to the microphone.
Good.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I really don't quite understand. The Office of Stabilization and Reconstruction is a key place for these issues, and I really don't understand what the current state of play is. Is there someone in the audience who can explain that?
I think I can. I work at USIP, but sometimes I think I work for SCRS. What's happened is that the coordinator of SCRS has been dual-hatted under the new foreign assistance reorganization at the State Department. So he will be deputy to Ambassador Tobias, but he will also report directly to the Secretary of State as coordinator for reconstruction and stabilization. I don't think it's a dilution. I don't think it's a. It's just a recognition that this is a. He has a relationship to foreign assistance, and that's going to be part of the strategy of foreign assistance planning. But he'll retain the separate office and the separate role, and separate funding. If anybody has anything,
is it a good thing?
Yeah, it is. I'm from the Department of State, Deborah Emmerich. Because we were there a week or so ago having a meeting with SCRS, and
could you stand
office,
up?
Our office, which is International Women's Issues at the State Department, we were over there having a meeting with SCRS last week or the week before. They explained that it just makes sense because there's so many different pots of money and funds, and it's always hard to determine exactly who's doing what with what pot of money and how it's being done, especially in these efforts for reconstruction, stabilization, post-conflict. Therefore, it just makes sense. It's intuitive to sort of have them working with F to be able to sort of just
Could you explain what F is?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, no clue.
Foreign assistance. It's the foreign assistance.
Oh.
It's what new, you say.
It's a new, yeah.
It's reconstructed.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
What?
To a degree. Yeah.
So there's no USAID anymore.
Didn't want this to be a primer on
this. No, we all need it.
But the Secretary of State, and then we now have two deputies, okay? There's the Deputy Negroponte, the traditional Deputy Secretary of State, and now the Senior Administrator of USAID, Tobias, equal to as a...
Not a deputy secretary, the equivalent, so there are now two.
So there's just better coordination of funding, of planning, of strategy, 10 years out, and that's very beneficial.
Very helpful.
Thank you. Thank you. Helpful to me.
Have anybody that... Yes, can you, do you want to go to the mic and introduce yourself?
Yes, sure. This is Iveta Chernova from International Peace Operations Association. I would like to thank all the speakers for excellent presentations. I would like to bring up the case of Liberia with President Ellen Johnson. And if you could please address that case, because it seems to me that, in a way, her approach is more of a top-down approach as opposed to the quotas. Becoming a president, coming to this position led to so many other changes. For example, appointment of a lot of ministers, Minister of Justice, female, many other female positions being created. So how do you see that playing out? And I guess what I'm saying is it could be done that way as well. So thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I don't disagree. However you can get them into these positions, great. One is not, it's not mutually exclusive. And they're complementary. I think so much of these recommendations have to look at the individual circumstances of a post-conflict situation to the extent we were trying to generalize. But I think the appointment of women into cabinet positions, absolutely critical. I'd even argue for quotas within that. Because, again, you're building expertise, you're changing the perspective. I think that in a post-conflict situation, you can afford lack of experience, and that you must.
Can I just add something really quickly to that? Actually, the Michelle Bachelet of Chile came in with a specific agenda to make her cabinet 50% women, 50% men. And I think that that really wakes people up, because it isn't, you know, Harriet made the comment that we're an all-female panel up here, but what's our topic? Our topic is women or gender, as opposed to our topic being,
boomers.
You know... Huh?
Bombers.
Bombers, right. You know, how many F-15s are we going to buy? How many of this? You know, I mean, as opposed to it being what would be considered a traditionally kind of male orientation. So the idea that Michelle Bachelet has a defense minister, that, you know, that there are more and more women in positions which are not just, you know, the minister of gender.
Yeah,
or the minister, the minister of culture, the minister of ethics and integrity, the minister of education. You know, not to demean those, but...
well, yeah. I think Chile is an excellent example, because not only were the defense, but the resources, you know, in a country that's so dependent on copper. I mean, these were in tough positions. Now it's not as post-conflict as it was years ago, but Chile is still coming out of the post-conflict, and it's relevant.
Yeah. Actually, WISE does panels on bombers with all females behind the table. to get back to your question, I think examples are good drivers of change.
Mm-hmm.
So, one.
Mm-hmm.
The other issue I'd like to sort of emphasize is the International Police Battalion, the Indian Police Battalion in Liberia,
mm-hmm.
and the kind of impact that is having, both in Liberia itself as well as within the UN. In Liberia, the police battalion is doing a terrific job. But one of the side advantages of it is that increasingly Liberian women are signing up for police training to be involved in Liberian police action. And I think that is a huge change. And they do this because, again, this example is there. So, and within the UN, I think it has also had quite an impact, because a lot of UN member states and a lot of people in the secretariat, there are some good people there, but there are a lot of people who are very skeptical about this. And that's when I said we need to work on our narrative to show that these things can work. We need to convince. There are lots of people still who need to be convinced that this is an important issue and that we have to work on this. So, and I think the Liberian police force is a real terrific example in that sense.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to add two comments. One is on the women as in terms of being heads of state or ministers. I think we're still in post-conflict countries, if I'm not correct, suffer from women being relegated to women Ministry of Women's Affairs, culture, education, and they're not yet breaking into the ranks. I'd love to see a woman minister of the interior somewhere. So that there's still some work to be done there. But the power of example is very important. I just got a call from Afghanistan from a woman parliamentarian wanting to know. She heard about the woman police unit in Liberia, and she thought that if we could get a woman police unit in Afghanistan, it would be extraordinarily helpful to help them break through on the recruiting problem with women in their police forces. So the power of best practices, you're right, best practices drive progress. And that's part of what we were trying to do in our working group and across these efforts, was to identify those best practices and then give them to policymakers. I think actually if you have the best practices come from people who come out of operations and who study these operations, and because we can't have an ongoing working group all the time, we need to have some mechanism to collect those. And the only thing that I've seen recently that is the Office of the Coordinator for Stabilization and Reconstruction at State Department actually has they have an interactive site where you can put in your best practice. You can say what you've learned from out there. And so hopefully more people will take advantage of that. It's something that we need to do better at. Did you say add something?
My only thought was, I think we should all say our prayers at night or in the morning whenever we say them, thanking whoever we thank for Michelle Bachelet and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. But these exercises that we've gone through, this collective group up here and that you all go through all the time, cannot be dependent on two women being elected president.
Right. Absolutely.
We need to amplify by making it part of our narrative. But please, let's think about drilling down to the concrete examples that we can give the people who are assigning the tasks out in post-conflict X country.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes, can you come to the microphone?
Is this better?
Yeah, great.
Ms. Cole, I've only spoken because you said you need to hear from more people who've been operational. My work is totally operational and in the field. I'm an ethnic Afghan, a Muslim woman, and a very proud American, and I say that very deliberately because having spent 3.5 years in the field in Iraq, and I don't mean the relative stability of either Kurdistan or the South, I worked in Al-Anbar province, Fallujah, Ramadi, Talafer, you name it, under combat conditions. Some of my closest allies were our own Marines and our own soldiers. The biggest frustration for somebody like myself has been that working in the field, the enemy comes in many guises. It isn't just Al-Qaeda, it isn't just the Ba'ath Party, it's not just the indigenous local extremist groups. It also, for me, and this is a very subjective observation, and those like me, came in the guise of State Department, USAID, with institutions like the UN and USIP being passive bystanders. That becomes really painful because we struggle and we work. There is no money left for places like Al-Anbar province, for the NGO community. In the end, people like myself end up using up all our own funds because we really believe in what we're doing. We've connected with the people there as well. It can be men, women, children. It can be old people. It can be young people, from farmers to anywhere else. The biggest problem for us is it becomes an issue of trust. Whom do we trust in the end? You know, somebody like myself has been called by the State Department to spy an SLUT and a subversive. Why? Simply because I happened to live in a village near Fallujah. I was captured by Zarqawi's people. My driver and I escaped 11 hours later. Yet, all we got was, you know, a lot of, you're just slammed. And there are more people like me. They just don't wish to come to forums like this. My friends convinced me, you have to come back to Washington. You have to participate in the system because the decisions are made here. I just don't know who's making them. And I don't know how we reach those people. And I don't even know if they want to hear from people like us. So what do you have to say to that?
Why don't you come up after and give us your card? I mean, I think there's certainly avenues and we can identify people for
talk to. I'd like to ask her to elaborate a little bit about why you think that the representatives of these institutions have that attitude. Is it fear of security? Is it that they feel they've got the outlets that they need?
I think it's several things. Fear of the unknown. You know, I was told many times by people who like me, they said, well, Muslim women who are bold and brassy like you, basically, if I wasn't a burqa babe or a talib bimbo and I was bold and brassy and I was out in the field, I could only either be a suicide.
This woman.
Well, the problem is they expect me to either be on my knees or to be a suicide bomber. And anything in between, and you know, I was interrogated again and again and again. I would be dragged into that darned embassy complex. I've got a retired colonel sitting here who was a witness to one of them. This poor fellow came and tried to save me. They wouldn't let him come in with me. So they would interrogate me. It would be anywhere from extreme, you know, sexual harassment to basically telling me, you're a Muslim, so you're a spy because you're a Muslim. I mean, it didn't matter, you know, whatever happened. Then I would be told, well, you're just too close to Iraqis. And I would say, excuse me, please tell me what I haven't understood. I'm supposed to be doing non-profit work over here. How can I do it if I am not in touch with a single Iraqi? Then I was too international. I spoke too many languages. I like people too much. How is it that I get along with both Americans and Iraqis as well as I do? It was ridiculous. It was absolutely ridiculous. And the State Department security, for me, has become worse than the Taliban. I mean, I have survived the ISI, Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence, which is one of the worst organizations in the world. I've survived the Taliban. I've survived the Mujahideen. All of them tried to kill me at one time or another. None of them disrespected me. The disrespect came from a handful of white boys in our embassy in Baghdad.
Why?
I don't think like them. You tell me why, ma'am. I don't know.
Why?
What was wrong with these men? And I really, my work carries on. The problem is, the next time it'll be without working with the establishment. I've seen my success at a grassroots level, and I had three poor Marine colonels come over to see me 2 weeks ago. They were briefed by me. I didn't know them. They'd gotten my name from another Marine colonel whom I didn't know. He got my name from an admiral I didn't know, and that admiral got it from somebody in Congress I didn't know. But at any rate, these three colonels came down here to Washington to be briefed by me over a two-day period. Obviously, that there's no money in that, but I feel if I can help them see something they're not seeing through their training, Well, that's wonderful. And what I basically told them is, I said, boys, I've seen Iraq go from very hopeful to somewhat hopeful to iffy to bad to worse to catastrophic. Mm-hmm. And you guys are now going in at the catastrophic stage. And I said, the bad news is you're going to Fallujah. But the good news is also you're going to Fallujah. That means you're away from the bastards in Baghdad. And what it basically means is, I said, don't try and do spectacular things. The time for that is gone. Just keep it local and keep it simple. And look out for the enemy within. Because what I told them is, the three of you are colonels. You will go to Fallujah and you will discover you are God. Just remember, you have to come back here, and you had a mission before you went. Keep focusing on that. Keep remembering, even when the Iraqi contractors throw money at you, that's not what you're supposed to do. Even worse, when the American contractors throw money at you. And worse than that, when your own co-workers tell you, well, if you're not going to be a part of that, at least look away. And those boys were horrified. They'd never heard anyone say that. They told me later on in the evening session, they said, you know, the three of us held hands and we said we've made a pact, we'll be the untouchables. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's
well,
that
you should,
kind
you should
of
take
thing.
Advantage of the State Department site. Put your story in.
Yeah.
But let me also just tell you that for 2 years at USIP, we've been holding a dialogue between the United States military and the main United States humanitarian organizations. We've agreed on some voluntary guidelines for relations between the NGOs and the military in these operations. And we're focused on operations like Iraq, where mm-hmm. they're more non-permissive, their security is
right,
an issue.
Right.
Hopefully it's going to be helpful, and everybody acknowledges, the NGOs and the military alike acknowledge that these environments have created such a tremendous strain on relationships mm-hmm. between civilian actors and military actors. And so what you're describing has been told inside this
right.
group for a couple of years now, and the challenge is to try to educate everyone so mm-hmm. that this distrust doesn't turn into this
animosity.
Yeah.
Outright
the question it raises for me is, to what degree the U.S. Or Western humanitarian organizations are partnering with the NGOs on the ground, because what we're asking the State Department, the military people mm-hmm. to do is first deal with an entity they don't understand,
mm-hmm.
NGOs, and secondly with a culture they don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
I think NGOs who work on the ground have a much better way of doing some intelligence or some vetting.
Absolutely.
That is not being taken mm-hmm. advantage of. I would even go so far as to say that if there were special funding for the NGOs,
oh, yes.
the international, to do this,
yes.
It just seems like a no-brainer to me. But
well, right from the beginning, ma'am, I got there 2 days before Saddam fell. And my thing was, I sat down with a young captain. Again, the most far-sighted people I met were the very junior officers and, this, you know, to some extent, my soldiers, corporals, privates, boys and girls that I lost, thank God, none of the girls. I mean, I'm not saying the boys were any less worth, but, you know, it was heart-wrenching. Every single time I lost someone, soldiers, Marines, or innocent Iraqi civilians, there I actually lost lots of women in the Iraqi civilian group. Mm-hmm. In the military group, it was only men. But these people, for me, were like children, like brothers and sisters, like parents. They become family. If I'm not going to believe in it, I can't do it. You don't give up a comfortable lifestyle here. You don't give up a life, period, to go and live in those conditions if you don't feel totally committed. But the problem for me has not been the military in the field. Those in uniform who worked in the field welcomed me, which was surprising. They didn't understand, but they wanted to understand because they saw me as a source of help to them. Mm-hmm. I had a special forces team come to me and say, look, we're not allowed to have women in the special forces. Washington's a long way off and we need to win a war. You're going to the same places we're going to. Do you mind riding around with us? And I said, no. I see some of my best work having been done with that unit. The problem was the State Department and USAID. They live in the safety of the green zone. Yes, they've got their swimming pools, they've got their alcohol, they've got a fairly decadent lifestyle. That's fine. They can do whatever they like. But then to impose what they do or do not know about the field onto those of us who are actually doing something constructive is very sad and begs the question, do they want Iraq to succeed?
Deborah, yeah, I was going to ask see if you guys wanted to comment.
I would really appreciate if you could identify the NGO you were with and your role there. You're talking about your boys and girls. Could you elucidate a little bit more? And also, secondly, I want to say this is one person's opinion.
Yeah.
Okay, you're speaking for yourself because I represent the State Department. I work every day with people in the field in Iraq, at the department, at the regional embassies. And they are an extremely dedicated bunch of people working under extremely adverse conditions. Okay, so we're not going to go to slamming unilaterally.
Yeah.
The Department of State.
They may be got well intentioned.
Could you identify
And part of the problem, you know, you go there in the beginning thinking, okay, let me do the usual women and children thing. But then you realize that the villages and the towns you're in have other problems. They need a sewer system. They need a water system. They've got an insurgency problem. All of a sudden your priorities change. You're trying to empower farmers. You cannot stick to that fancy little plan. Now, when you talk about people in the regional offices, if one has access to them, it's wonderful.
Well, who is one? Do you mean yourself?
Yeah, well, not just myself. There were other smaller NGO groups. I call them the lightning operation.
Yes, because we are aware of our regional offices that have, where NGOs are going in and working with them. We implement, Steve and I implement $14.5 million NGO plan, okay, on the ground in Iraq to local partners. Can you identify the NGO?
We should get our association. And I actually came to the State Department here and talked to some really good people who are in the State Department. The problem is they said that they could not do whatever was happening on the ground.
Deborah, you know what? I think this is a really important discussion.
Yeah,
and
I could not let this just go.
No, it's a really important discussion. I'm glad that you raised these points. I think that we should continue it and perhaps not in this room at this time, but it's extremely important. Thank you.
Just in closing, the Department of State is doing incredible work. You may agree or not agree with the policy. Mm-hmm. Okay? We have the policies we have. Mm-hmm. But within the structure of the policies in place, it is amazing how hard everyone is working both here in the United States and overseas to try and make a difference for women and for civil society.
I didn't recognize Deborah, but Deborah and Steve together and with USIP and others have been working with a working group on Iraqi women's empowerment. And I'm telling you that you couldn't find two more dedicated people to the cause of Iraqi women than Steve and Deborah. So again, let's continue this, because you raised some very important points.
Pamela.
I just want to emphasize something. I think this has been a very interesting conversation, but it does bring up one of the points that everyone mentioned it, but I just want to emphasize it a little bit more. I'm Pamela All, and I'm here at USIT, but I'm also in WISE, so I'm talking for two of these organizations. But it is the whole, I think we focus very much on the demand organizations, the ones that are going to get women out in the field, the UN, the U.S. government, and so forth. I think we also just have to take a look at the life of the supplier, the women who will step up to these jobs and who will fulfill our expectations and show the world that women really have a huge part to play. And this is another aspect of what we are doing in WISE over the next year. We are looking at, there is, even in this country, there's a dramatic fall off in numbers between the schools of international relations, where, you know, maybe 60% of the women who go into this field are trained, and the senior positions. And we don't think it's all glass ceiling.
we think that there are things that go on in women's lives that we don't still, you know, either recognize or understand well enough that cause them to leave the field at some point. And this is something that I'm sure is happening all over the world. So again, just some encouragement that we look at the conditions of the suppliers as well as the demanders.
Good. Well, I want to thank you. Clearly, our work is cut out for us, but but we're going to continue, and hopefully, with all of you, we can make some change. Thank you so much.
So you have made the time.
Yeah, because it's a luxury. Yeah, little things improve.